Minerva was quieter than normal when David and Stevie walked into the common room. The moose head on the wall was the only witness, and for a moment, Stevie wondered if it had been mounted with cameras. Moose eye cameras. Did Edward King want to watch and see when his son got back to his dorm? A stupid thought. A nervous thought. Her palms were sweating. David was just behind her, and she could feel his shadow on her back, like it was made of fingers. Janelle? She called. Nothing. Nate, you here? The moose just stared ahead.
Told you, David said. All ours, nice and cozy.
Just her and David alone in the house. The whole house. Alone.
Is the door locked?
David produced a key from his pocket.
Where did you get that?
Don't worry about it, he said.
Even in the bright midday sun, the hallway in Minerva was very dark, lit only by a very tiny stained glass window by the stairs at the end of the hall. There was a wall sconce, but no one ever turned it on during the day. Stevie walked gently past Janelle's room and her own, down to the end, where room 3 lay waiting. Ellie's room was just a little bit different from Janelle's and Stevie's. It was a touch larger, with a little alcove nook. There were 3 small boxes piled there, so some of her stuff was still here, but by no means all. When Stevie had last been in this room, the bed was piled in colorful blankets and spreads. There was stuff everywhere. Art supplies, paints and pastels and pencils, boas, piles of dirty but colorful clothes, books, prints and drawings, and melted down candles, and wine bottles with peacock feathers coming out of them. Those things were all gone. The bed now looked like what it was, a small wooden institutional frame with a plastic-covered mattress. The poems and drawings Ellie had put on the wall were still there, like ancient graffiti. Quotes, song lyrics, snatches of poetry in French and English, slashes of color, crude and bright drawings, splatters. Ellie's mind was an active and colorful place, and she decorated her world with its contents. The way to handle a scene was to start wide and work your way in. So that's what Stevie did. She walked around the edge of the room first, looking at the writings and drawings, checking in the drawers and closets to see if anything had been left behind. The bureau top still had a thick covering of makeup dust and wax, as did the bedside stand. Stevie opened the closet door. There was nothing but a crumpled plastic shopping bag. When she had satisfied herself that the room itself had nothing to tell her, she went to the boxes and had a careful look through. The top one contained clothes, as David said. Ellie's thrift store finds and Parisian punk, balled-up vintage t-shirts, flowing hippie pants covered in paint, objects that defied definition. The next box contained what appeared to be the used bedding stripped off the bed, and the box below that, towels and bath supplies. Stevie looked through Ellie's mix of store-brand shower gels and shampoos and her French body oils before putting everything back in the boxes.
Anything?
David said from the window.
How are the little gray cells? She waved him off.
This room had contained everything of Ellie's here at Ellingham. She'd had the magic tin in this room. Stevie had to try harder. What did this space tell her about Element Walker? Stevie got down on the floor on her stomach and rested her chin in her hands. Old glitter still sparkled from the floorboards, and bits of feather were snagged on splintered pieces of the wood. Down here, she could smell Ellie's incense, the endless incense she burned against the school rules. No fires, Ellie, Stevie said out loud.
What?
David said from the window.
The first thing I heard about Ellie on the first day, before you got here. You were late and we were having the orientation talk thing.
Stevie scanned the room from her vantage point. A vista of dust bunnies.
Pix said to her, no fires, Ellie.
Ellie must have caused a fire?
Oh, yeah, last year. She knocked a candle over.
In here?
Yeah, in here.
And yet she can't light a match, Stevie said, mostly to herself. She pushed herself back up to her knees. Where do you look for Ellie, the smoker who can't light a match? Albert Ellingham was trying to find people, too. He was always looking for his lost daughter. All of this was about his lost daughter. And now there was another lost daughter on the mountain. Against a box by the door, Stevie saw Ruta, Ellie's beloved saxophone. Ellie could not play the saxophone, but that never stopped her. She had purchased Ruta with the money Hayes gave her to write the end of it all, and that money came from Hayes' ex-girlfriend Gretchen. The day Stevie met Ellie, she was playing Ruta in the tub at the end of the hall while dyeing her dress and herself pink. It was there that Stevie discovered the bits of metal under the tub, the ones that had marked Hayes' computer when Ellie stashed it there. So much of this came down to Ruta. Stevie went over and picked up the saxophone. That's when she saw it, a scorch mark leading up to the wall. The mark had been scrubbed over, painted away, and something else. Something wasn't right in that little patch of the room. "Don't you think it's weird about the matches?" Stevie said, getting down to look at the wall.
"That's why I said it."
"No," Stevie said. "You said it to me to explain why you didn't think she would do well alone in the woods. Don't you think that's odd? Ellie's an artist. She's good with her hands." It looked like something had fallen. There was one dark mark that stretched out. But the weird thing was that something about the wall was uneven. She got right up to it and ran her hand along it to the molding between the wall and the floor. There was a gap. A tiny, tiny gap, a few millimeters. "Pass me my bag," she said to David. He pushed her bag in her direction. She yanked it over and shuffled through it until she found a pen. She pulled off the cap and used it to pry into the space. David made his way over to her and perched next to her, sitting on his heels. "Turn on your phone flashlight," she said.
"What is it?"
"I don't know yet," she said impatiently. "Flashlight." He turned on the flashlight function. By now, Stevie had wiggled the board free. It gave rather easily. It had been pulled loose before, clearly. Behind it was a hole in the base of the wall, about the size of a fist. David had no snark now. He silently handed her the flashlight. Before she took it, she reached into the front pocket of her bag and pulled out a pair of blue nitrile gloves and snapped them on.
"Really?"
he said.
"You carry crime scene gloves?"
"You can get them in any drugstore," she said, taking the phone from him. "Treat yourself." She flattened herself on the floor as best she could and turned her head to the side to get a view into the space. It appeared to be a shallow space, dark, webby. She positioned the phone's light to get the best illumination she could and reached in slowly in case there were wires or sharp edges. She poked finger by finger until she hit the back of the space. It was about as long as her hand, almost big enough for the tin, but not quite. She lifted her neck and stretched it, then reached her fingers up. There was space there. The hollow went all the way up, plenty of space for the tin.
"So there is a hole?"
David said.
"That's pretty good. I mean, you never disappoint with your..."
"Shut up for a second." She craned her hand around to get a full sense of what might be there. "Maybe Janelle has one of those laparoscopic little cameras," she said. "Or..." Her finger hit something. Something fabric. "I've got something," she said. She wormed her fingers into the space, looking for something she could hook onto. Was it more of the beaded fabric? Or the thing the feather had come from? Was it more of the photos? A bag? The thing pulled free and landed on the floor inside the hole. She wrapped her hand around it and was pulling it out when her brain sent her the alert that something was amiss with this object. But sometimes when you start a movement, you can't stop. She pulled the thing out of the hole. Whether it was a large mouse or a small rat, she did not know. It was dead, and had been for some time. It still had fur in places, but in others it was exposed to the bone. Overall, it was hard. Possibly mummified by being in the wall. "Oh," she said, jerking away her hand. It was not an adequate expression of horror, but it was all she had. When you find yourself holding a mummified mouse rat, words may fail.
"That's not Ellie,"
David said, looking over and grimacing. Stevie got up and scooted away from the thing. Ripping off her gloves, she shoved them in her hoodie pocket.
Are you keeping those?
He said. I can't put them in the trash in here, she replied.
You think they're checking her trash?
I don't know. You asked me to come in here.
Okay.
He held up his hands.
What do you think?
Stevie surveyed the room again. What was she wearing that night? Stevie asked.
She had ballet shoes on, he said. I remember looking at them.
And a little dress. Ballet shoes and a little dress. He had a good point. It would be hard to get down the mountain in that. The room told her about Ellie, that she was a freewheeling artist, an impractical dresser, a French speaker, messy. She liked wine and cabaret. She had a lot of colored pens and drawing books. Her medium was everything. She was color and glitter and chaos. David was looking at her expectantly, waiting for her to make some kind of proclamation. But she had nothing. The room had no secrets to share. The only thing it had given her was a dead rodent, and now she had to get rid of it. Let me think, she said. David's phone buzzed. He looked at it.
Looks like I have a date. Gotta go up to the Great House. Someone thinks I put a bunch of squirrels in the library.
He tucked his phone in his pocket.
Thanks for looking. Maybe it was stupid.
He shrugged.
Better go.
When he was gone, Stevie found herself quaking internally. And it wasn't just because she had to scoop up the rat with some cardboard and take it out to the woods. 8. Detection has many methods, many pathways, narrow and subtle. Fingerprints. The lost piece of thread. The dog barking in the night. But there is also Google. After dumping the rat, Stevie sat down and looked up the names she had uncovered. Frances Josephine Crane had lived long before the existence of social media, long before every moment and movement could be tracked. But she still lived in a time where the life events of a prominent young woman could be traced. That she was a prominent young woman was the first thing Stevie found out when she sat down in her own room. Frances Crane was the daughter of Louis Crane, the founder and owner of a company called Crane Flower. The internet had plenty to say about Crane Flower, one of America's most popular brands between 1910 and 1945. Many people collected Crane Flower tins. The most important fact about Crane Flower seemed to be that one of their factories exploded in 1927, killing 8 people and wounding 30. Crane was roundly denounced for insufficient safety precautions, and Crane Flower winked out of existence about 20 years later, purchased by some larger company that folded it into another company and into another. Frances hid among these stories, concealing herself in the depths of available information. Stevie caught a glimpse of her in a list of attendees at a ball held in New York on September 19, 1936. Then her name appeared in a list of the 1937 incoming class at Vassar. There was no mention of her in any list of graduates. Finally, Stevie found herself reading selections from a book called Better Than Homemade, The Story of Baking in America, which was published in 1992 and patchily uploaded in the form of a bunch of bad scans. This was the longest piece of information she could find on Frances. Louis's daughter, Frances, was well known for her literally hell-raising ways. In despair, her parents sent her away to join the first class of their friend, Albert Ellingham's new academy in the hills of Vermont. Unfortunately, her stay there was concurrent with the infamous Ellingham kidnapping, and she returned home. The Crane family, it seemed, attracted disaster. What do you mean, literally hell-raising ways? Stevie said aloud. She literally raised hell? What, is she summoning demons? There were other annoying things, like the fact that the author said hills of Vermont and not mountains. So it made the claim that Frances and her family attracted disaster seem a little dubious. But still, this was an intriguing paragraph.
It was also the only one that mentioned Frances. Stevie found the author's name, Anne Abbott, and read down the list of her other works. Jell-O, The Wobble That America Loves. Salad Days, How Salad Became Popular. Another few minutes of poking around produced an email address. Stevie wrote her an email and asked her if she had any information about what became of Frances. She had just sent it when there was a knock at her door and Janelle poked her head in.
What are you up to?
She asked. Stevie glanced up at the corner of her screen and realized that she had been scouring the internet for Frances Crane for over 3 hours. It was almost 6:30.
Work,
she said, shutting her computer. Lots to catch up on. Janelle stepped into the room. The light smell of lemons trailed in with her.
You're wearing your lemons, Stevie said. For luck?
I'm just happy you're back,
Janelle said, sitting on the edge of Stevie's bed.
When I'm happy, for luck, I just love lemons.
Here, I made you something. She handed Stevie a small plastic object about the size of a deck of cards with two wheels.
It's a self-balancing robot, she said. You can attach your phone to it.
I was playing around with some spare parts and working on inertial measurement units, and I just wanted to make you something, so... She shrugged happily as Stevie accepted her friendship robot.
How's your project going? Stevie asked.
I'm glad you asked. Do you want to see specs?
Janelle bounced off the bed and returned a minute later with her laptop open. She showed Stevie several videos of machines rolling around and swinging things. She had the same intensity that Stevie had when she was talking about murders, except this was pipes and motors and things that spun and moved. All of this was interspersed with a detailed analysis of Janelle's favorite K-drama, Love Lessons with Tofu. Janelle's mind was a busy but perfectly organized place, running like one of her impossible machines. TV show plots ran alongside mathematical formulas, which blended seamlessly into smoky eye tutorials, which catapulted her into romance before dropping her gently back into a bed of physics. And also, she answered every single one of her texts within a minute. She did not, however, know about crime, and she would probably not be interested in what Stevie had just discovered, or not discovered, really, about someone who was related to someone else who made flour. Janelle's phone buzzed, and she glanced down at it.
Everyone's going over to the yurt, she said. Vi is on their way over.
You and Vi seem so happy. Janelle did a tiny squee. It was an actual squee, a real one. A pip of joy.
I'm trying to learn a little Korean, Janelle said, but languages aren't really my thing. Vi's fluent in Korean and Japanese, and they thought I'd like to learn Korean the most. Do you want to go over? Let's get Nate and go over.
Before Ellingham, yurts had not been a part of Stevie's life. She had never even heard of them. When she first saw the massive, circular tent structure, it reminded her of a circus, both inside and out. Outside, all big top. Inside, it was a mass of colorful rugs, bean bags, futons, and cushions. It was the place where people gathered to hang out, play games, read, do work. It was a strange structure. It had no windows, and the inside was a skeleton of sunburst beams that supported the ceiling and a lattice that held up the walls. There was a wood-burning stove in the middle that kept it all toasty, and lights and colorful decorations hung from the ceiling. Janelle and Vi sat propped up back-to-back on the floor. Nate was sitting with them, though his attention was on a game on his tablet. The school was abuzz with the story of the squirrels. It seemed common knowledge that it was David's doing, and he had not yet returned from his trip to the Great House. Back in Pittsburgh, if someone had infiltrated the library with 50 squirrels, that person would have been hailed as a hero. But Ellingham was full of library lovers, and there was the feeling in the air that this was, perhaps, a bridge too far. You could be naked, you could scream and hang out on the roof, but you do not mess with the place with the books.
Nothing else got him kicked out,
Nate mumbled as the topic floated up in their group.
If they can prove it, Vi said. I guess they have footage. They have footage of everything because now we live in a surveillance state.
Janelle rolled her eyes just a tiny, tiny bit.
Seriously, Vi said. People are saying those cameras we got, They're from someone on the outside. The school didn't want them.
Then who bought them? Janelle said.
I don't know. It's private, though. I know you think I'm a paranoid protester, but it's true.
Stevie bit her lower lip. It appeared that no one knew about Edward King's connection to the school. This meant that the helicopter had not been seen up close. Stevie felt like she was sitting on a secret, palpably, like it was an egg. If she moved, it would crack open.
I don't know, Janelle said. I get the problem, but I don't hate the cameras. There are things around. Bears and moose.
No moose, Stevie said. The moose is a lie.
I'm just saying that considering everything that happened, cameras aren't completely the worst idea.
All I'm saying, Vi said, steering the topic back to even ground, is they must have seen him do it.
A new person came up to where they were sitting. He was tall.
Actually, he was by far the tallest student at Ellingham, and maybe the tallest Stevie had ever seen.
She practiced measuring people by height, as that was a useful observational skill. Witnesses routinely got heights wrong. The best way to note a height was to measure it against something that didn't move. In this case, this person was up to a large knot in the wood of the latticework that held up the yurt wall. Based on her other observations, this probably put the guy at 6'4", maybe 5. He had a full build, like a football player, or like how Stevie guessed football players were built. They existed at her old school, but they were not present for Stevie. She didn't care enough to make note of them. Stevie hated football, and she specifically hated the car commercials that were in football with the meaningless slogans and aggressively masculine messages about how important it was for Americans to drive up rocks and treat every trip to the store or a soccer game like a single-person invasion. Maybe she was overthinking this. This person probably did not play football. He was fiercely pale, not like Nate, who had a gentle, bookish gray tone. This was a kind of paper white, contrasted sharply by jet black, obviously dyed hair. He had purple cat-eye contacts in, wore a slip-knot t-shirt, and had spiked black leather cuffs on both wrists.
Hi, he said softly to Stevie. I'm Mudge. I don't think we met before, but Pix asked me to get you up to speed on anatomy stuff. Do you want a Pringle?
His voice was so soothing, he sounded like someone who might be on a recording or one of the meditation apps Stevie used when she had anxiety.
I'm okay, Stevie said.
Nate peered up from his tablet and he seemed to regard Mudge as some kind of fellow traveler.
Yeah, I want a Pringle, Nate said.
The can of Pringles was extended, and Mudge entered the group. To Stevie's surprise, he and Nate immediately started talking about a board game. Stevie was adrift in her small group, alone. Then she felt them. The eyes of Jermaine Bat. They were watching her from across the room.
I'll be right back, she told the others.
Jermaine Bat was petite, just touching 5 feet. She had long, straight hair that today she pulled back in a bun. Like Stevie, she dressed for the job she wanted to have. She wore a black blazer with a white t-shirt under it, as if she might be called to be a talking head on the news at any time. She was sitting by herself on a poof. Not in the corner, as yurts have no corners, but tucked off into a nook with some screens and a coffee table. She sat alone, bent over her laptop. She was typing away when Stevie approached, but there was no pretense. They both knew they had been staring each other down.
Welcome back, Jermaine said.
Her voice had a high register, and her words a hard, fast clip. She spoke like she typed.
Thanks.
Stevie tried not to overload the word. It wasn't Jermaine's fault that her article caused her parents to remove her from Ellingham. She didn't mean for it to happen. Still, it was hard not to feel the connection between Jermaine and being ripped from the mountain and thrown back to the earth below.
Something wrong? Jermaine asked.
No.
Seems like something's wrong. By the way, you still owe me a favor from that night.
Stevie had forgotten about this. At the silent party, when Stevie was trying to figure out who had taken Hayes's computer, she had asked Jermaine to show her some photos on her phone.
She had promised a favor in return, but she didn't really think that she would be hit up for it.
You figured it out because of my picture,
Germaine reminded her.
I know. So what do you want?
Nothing yet,
Germaine said.
When it's time, I'll ask.
Stevie found she was clenching her jaw. She consciously released it, but it snapped right back into position.
So,
Germaine said, half closing her computer.
What do you think happened?
With?
Ellie,
Germaine said, as if this was obvious.
I think she got out through a passageway,
Stevie said.
Yeah?
Germaine rolled her eyes.
But where did she go?
Stevie didn't like being treated like she was stupid, but since she had just had this conversation with David, she decided to take the indignity to find out why Germaine was also asking this question.
Burlington?
Stevie said innocently.
How did she get there?
Germaine said.
You can't walk there. She didn't call anyone. They have her cell phone records.
She could have used another phone.
Whose?
Germaine asked, raising an eyebrow.
Maybe a friend's?
As if on cue, the door to the yurt flapped open and David entered. David had a way of walking, a way that suggested that he belonged anywhere he went. In this, he had his father's manner, which was gross and horrific. But there was something else, something of the rake in a casino movie who has come in to knock the place over, or an entertainer who might at any point somersault into the center of the room. Or maybe he was just walking in and her brain chemistry was telling her stories. He had changed his clothes and was now wearing jeans and a form-fitting black sweater, which complemented his dark curls and made the musculature of his arms and chest clear. He smiled at her and Germaine, then went over to Janelle and Vi. Mudge and Nate had gone to examine some of the board games on the shelves.
A friend's phone?
Germaine said again.
Yeah, Stevie said, getting up. I don't think so.
Maybe worth finding out.
Germaine called to her as she rejoined her housemates. David was leaning on the back of the futon, talking to Janelle and Vi. Janelle had her face tipped up toward him, an expression of dull patience on her face. Vi's arms were crossed. They did not look impressed.
I'm on house arrest,
he said.
No trips to Burlington for me.
Seriously?
Janelle replied.
I know, he said. I don't think they can do that.
No, she said. That's it?
Isn't that enough?
He said.
I didn't even do anything.
Yes, you did, Vi said. Everyone knows you did.
Am I the squirrel whisperer?
It's not cool, Vi said. You've been waking people up. You're damaging stuff we like that we use. We all have issues, dude. Get over yourself.
I thought learning was a game, David said. Why is no one having fun but me?
Vi shook their head and took Janelle's hand. The two of them stood up.
I'll see you at home,
Janelle said, and it was pointedly to Stevie only.
Sometimes I don't think people like me,
David said, watching them go. You know why, she said.
A return to responsibility,
he said, lifting his eyebrows rakishly.
You know who loves that?
A lot of people, Stevie said.
Just because...
It seemed too dangerous to say your dad out loud. Stevie could feel Germaine's eyes on them, boring into the back of her head.
I think I might go too, she said. Want to come?
Sure, he said. Why not?
Germaine kept her head down as they passed, but Stevie saw her stealing a sideways glance at them.
It was only like 40 squirrels,
David said when they were outside.
How did you even get 40 squirrels?
No magician reveals his secrets,
he said.
You didn't find anything else, did you?
His change of conversation was so sudden that Stevie lost the thread for a second.
Look, Stevie said, what are you suggesting happened to Ellie? You're saying you don't think she could have made it out, so you think she's here?
I'm saying,
he lowered his voice.
I don't see how she made it away from here that night. Or the next few days. I don't know how she got out.
But let's say she did, because that's probably what happened, Stevie said. Do you know where she'd go?
She could have gone anywhere,
he said.
Ellie grew up on a commune. She lived in France. I guess she's in a... I don't know. In a cafe basement in Berlin or something.
Kind of hard for her to get out of the country.
Okay, so... In an Airstream trailer in Austin selling designer tacos, or a treehouse in Oregon.
I get the idea, Stevie said. She's not from anywhere, so if she's nowhere, it's like she's home. David regarded her for a moment.
Right, he said. If she's nowhere, she's home. Yeah.
Or she can just be in someone's apartment in Burlington, Stevie said.
I think she would want to get out. If she could get to Burlington, she could get in someone's car and go. I don't think she'd stick around.
But why run? Stevie said. Why run if you did nothing?
Fear,
David said. Of what?
Of being accused of murder.
I never said she did it, Stevie shot back. I said she wrote the script for the end of it all and took Hayes's computer, which she did.
I know, he said. I know. Calm down.
Do not tell me to calm down, Stevie replied. I'm the one who started this. I know what I'm saying. It's just... If not her...
Look, David said, maybe he did take the dry ice. Maybe Beth Brave was wrong about when she thought they were talking.
There's a call record.
I know, but what if it was wrong somehow?
Or what if Ellie did do it, Stevie said. She had motive. She had the ability. She could have done it as a goof to mess with the video. She doesn't seem like someone who would know all the science. Why would she think that would hurt him?
Because that's not how she was,
David said.
She wouldn't move hundreds of pounds of dry ice to mess up someone else's art.
For the first time, she heard his voice take on a raw edge. I'm just saying.
Look, I get what you did, and it makes sense. I'm just telling you, she wouldn't do that. The one thing Ellie would never do is mess up someone else's art. That was like her religion. I know things ended kind of weird with us, and maybe you don't trust me, but you have to trust me.
It was a sudden twist. You mean how your dad isn't dead and is Edward King? She asked.
I mean, if you want to get super specific about it. Just so you know, I wanted to tell you. I wanted to tell you right away. But there were two reasons I didn't. One, because my dad is Edward King, which means you would hate me. And two, my dad is Edward King, which means everyone would hate me.
I didn't even know he had kids, Stevie said. I didn't know he could mate with humans.
Yeah,
David said.
Nature finds a way.
Had he moved closer? It seemed like he might have. Stevie's mouth had gone dry. The thing about David was that he was very beautiful, long and lean and damaged and twisted, smiling at her. She saw Edward King's silhouette in David's features again, in his smile. Good job, Stevie. That's right. Kiss him. That will make him happy. Stevie stepped back a few feet, repelled by the thought. Her brain could not handle this conflict of input. There was something there, something that pulsed between her and David. And now there was Edward King hanging overhead, almost literally. He even had cameras on them. The thought made her queasy. I should have told Nate I was going, she said. I'm going to go back. Tell him. David lifted his chin an inch.
Sure,
he said with the slightest trace of a smile.
Nate, yeah. I'll see you at home.
He turned and started walking back toward Minerva, his hands in his pockets. Stevie stood on the path, trying to take in all the new information that shaped her life. She had always wondered how people got to lead interesting lives. Maybe this was how. You set up the conditions, and then you get the events. And maybe those events took you by surprise, even if you wanted them to happen, even if you prepared. She had wished so much to work on this case, and now here she was, doing deals with the devil. Maybe, she wondered, that was what it was like to plan a murder. Maybe you make successive bad deals with yourself that you can't back out of, until you make one that can never be reversed.
April 14th, 1936, 6 a.m. At the start, there was much Frances Crane admired about Albert Ellingham. She was inclined to like a man who built tunnels for no apparent reason. He encouraged her love of chemistry. He instructed the librarian to order whatever crime magazines she wanted to read. Boys and girls took exercise together, took class together, shared meals. He told the staff to turn the other way when students were caught drinking. He liked to play games, and he and Frances had gone toe-to-toe in Monopoly several times. Her appreciation for the man peaked when he took her on a walk of the property and showed her where they had blasted away the mountain with dynamite. He even took Frances to where the explosives were stored and let her hold a stick in her hands. She tried not to show her excitement, but it must have come through.
"You seem interested," he said with a laugh.
"Go on. Tell me about dynamite."
"It's simply nitroglycerin, stabilized and absorbed by diatomaceous earth and sodium carbonate," Frances said. "Unless you're using TNT, which is..."
"Well," he said, laughing. "I wasn't expecting an answer that quickly."
He reached out to take the stick back, and Frances's fingers reflexively coiled around it before she told them to release.
"It's a good thing you'll never need this," he said. "You could be dangerous."
"I might be," she said. Albert Ellingham roared with laughter.
"I have to be careful what we're teaching you," he said, laughing again. "Your father would murder me if I made you too dangerous to marry."
That was the moment it all broke for Frances. He had given her dynamite, and he had laughed in her face. It was a joke to him, something he would never think of again. But it would be all Frances would think of. She decided that if he liked games so much, she would play one of her own. It would be a good game, too. Edward liked her idea of fun, so they made their great plan together. The letter hadn't even been important to the plan. It had been, in Eddie's words, a bit of art. She'd gotten the idea from the true crime magazines that she loved so much. People in those magazines were always getting kidnapped, and the kidnappers always sent the messages with the cutout letters. She assumed this was a made-up thing, but one day she was sitting on the lawn reading Real Detective when she saw the man who was always hanging around, the one everyone knew was a cop. His name was George Marsh. He'd been all over the papers when he stopped a bomb from going off in Albert Ellingham's car. Frankie always read stories about bombs. Now he seemed to be Ellingham's private bodyguard. He was walking toward the great house when she called out to him, making sure to use the purest form of her Tony New York voice. "Aren't you a policeman?" she asked. Mr. Marsh had come over to her, looking bemused.
"I am," he said. "Or I used to be. I work for the FBI.
"Oh, that must be so exciting. You must have seen all sorts of things. Tell me, do real criminals send notes like this?"
She held up her magazine, open to a page that showed such a note. He smiled.
"I'm surprised you read this kind of thing. Doesn't seem very Ellingham Academy."
"Oh," she said, "I love it. This story is about a kidnapping. Have you ever worked on a kidnapping?"
"Once," he said. "They're not all that common."
"What was it?"
"A banker's wife," he said. "Kidnapped while leaving her bridge club."
"Was there a ransom letter?"
"A call," he said. "Not a letter. They wanted $50,000.
"What happened?" Frankie said, making sure to widen her eyes and look as innocent as possible.
"The banker paid. She never came home. Turns out she'd run off with her tennis instructor and the 50 grand was for them. We tracked them down in Miami."
He stubbed out his cigarette on the ground.
"Crank letters are often pretty dull," he said. "Once in a while you get a live one. One like that, with all those cutout letters. You'd remember one like that. But I'll get in trouble with the management if I stand here talking about crime when you're supposed to be studying. Looks like you've got a serious book under that magazine."
He was correct. Frances had a textbook under the magazine. She was doing both.
"Organic chemistry,"
she replied.
Better you than me, kid. I never had the brains for that.
He grinned and tipped his hat to her and continued on to the house. Frankie chewed the end of her pencil.
You'd remember one like that.
The idea came into her head at that moment. What if they sent him a letter? It was a joke at first. They'd never really send Albert Ellingham a note like this. But the longer she turned the idea over, the more it gained mass and form. The thing could be done. It just had to be done carefully and with style. Why not rattle the old boy's chain? Why not give him a little taste of her spark? When she told Edward the idea that night, he loved it at once. He called it Dada-esque, and being Edward, he elaborated on it, made it a poem.
Poetic justice, he said before kissing her.
Edward showed her a poem by Dorothy Parker that they modeled their work on. There were so many lovely ways to describe fiendish things. Edward added a ha-ha at the end. It had to be signed, and this was the final flourish. It has to be truly devious, Frankie said.
Perfect!
Edward added this to the draft. Truly devious. For the actual construction of the letter, they lay together on the floor of the empty, newly constructed swimming pool, smoking and picking out letters. The paper was from a notepad Frankie brought from New York. Basic household stuff. They wore gloves and used tweezers, applying each letter carefully, tilting some, spacing them irregularly. When the letter was complete, Frankie finished off the plan. She paid one of the day laborers to dump a pile of her mail into a Burlington post box, saying they were personal letters and that the staff at the school went through their mail. For a dollar, her mail got the right postmark on the right date, placing them nowhere near the scene. A beautiful piece of criminal art. But now that letter had been swept into something else. Something that had taken Iris and Alice Ellingham. And what about Dottie Epstein? These were the things Frances wondered about as she spent a sleepless night on the sofa. Would it be seen as a joke? Would it be traced? The man with the shotgun sat by the door all night. He did not sleep. Neither did Miss Nelson, who spent the night moving around silently, bringing things down from her room in bags, going through paperwork. She cast only the occasional look at Frances, who gave up and nodded off. At daybreak, the other girls were awoken and told to dress.
"What's happening?"
said Gertie, scuffing out in her heeled slippers.
"Nothing to worry about,"
Miss Nelson said stiffly.
"A bomb threat was made. Nothing will happen, but for safety's sake, you're all being sent away from campus."
There were cries and shouts and excitement about this change in routine. There was a rush for the bathroom and dresses and coats. What would they bring? Would there be breakfast? In the melee, Frances stole down to her room and slipped inside. There were things she would need. Things that were concealed in her room, things she could not leave behind. She got next to her bureau and began to push. When she had moved it about a foot, she got down on the floor with a nail file and was about to start working the skirting loose when Miss Nelson was in the doorway.
"What are you doing?"
Miss Nelson said.
"I dropped an earring,"
Frances replied coolly.
"Come back into the common room. I need to change."
Miss Nelson went to Frances's closet, grabbed a dress, and handed it to her, then pointed to Frances's decorative screen.
"Change, then."
Frances took the dress and stepped behind the screen.
"I'll just say this,"
Miss Nelson said.
"What is happening here is very serious. Talking too much could get people hurt. Do you understand me?"
Frances stopped with her dress halfway over her head.
"I don't care what you think you know," Miss Nelson went on. "There are lives at stake. I know you like your games, Frances, but this is real. People could die, and one of your own housemates could be in danger."
Frances gulped in some air, pulled the dress down, and stepped out from behind the screen. Miss Nelson was no longer the gentle and meek head of Minerva. She was a woman standing like a wall in her doorway. And for the first time that whole night and morning, Frances was afraid. She looked down at the spot in the skirting board. What was behind that board could cause more trouble than she wanted. Her secrets were sealed in that wall.
"Could I just have a moment?"
she asked as meekly as she could.
"No,"
Miss Nelson said.
"I will pack your things. You will go."
Frances Josephine Crane walked out of her room, having no idea it was for the last time.
9. There was the moose sign again. There would never be a moose. The Ellingham coach was going on its Sunday run to Burlington. Only a few people were on today, not people Stevie knew well. Everyone had headphones on or was reading or playing something. Stevie was reading her tablet, where she had a copy of Truly Devious, The Ellingham Murders by Dr. Irene Fenton open. It was one of the first books she had ever gotten on the subject. She had flipped to the part about the discovery of Dottie Epstein.
May 16th, 1936, was a soft day with hints of an early summer. It was 5:30 in the morning, and Joseph Vance had started his milk run from Archer's Dairy Farm. He had 35 deliveries of milk, cream, and butter in the back of his truck, and a vacuum flask of coffee for his journey. He had just made the first 10 deliveries to houses outside of Jericho, Vermont, and it was a good time to pull off to the side of the road and have a mug of coffee and his breakfast roll. He parked on a bit of rough grass across from Babbitt's farm, drank and ate, and when he was finished, he went to relieve himself by a tree some 20 feet back from the road. Joseph would later say he had no idea what moved him to go so far from the truck. This was a quiet area. No one was around for miles. Still, he moved back to the privacy of the tree, and while he was going about his business, he saw what appeared to be a sack on the ground. He moved closer. This is when he realized there were two legs coming from the sack, or at least parts of legs. They were discolored, ravaged by weather and wildlife. The rest of the body was still under a bit of dirt and some loose bits of wood. When Joseph moved these away, he saw the girl's curly hair, the remains of her face, and even a pair of glasses. He ran several feet away and was violently ill. Then he got in his truck and drove directly to the police station. Little Dolores Epstein, the brilliant young student from the Ellingham Academy, had finally been found. When the body was removed and examined, a massive fracture would be found on the right side of her skull. At that point, the Ellingham kidnapping became the Ellingham murder. In all of the publicity around the missing mogul's wife and his daughter, many would forget that the first known victim was a student, a poor little girl from New York City, a girl who taught herself five languages and showed a prodigious gift for translating ancient texts, a girl who did college-level chemistry and physics, who had a near photographic memory of everything she ever read. Later, Dolores's movements on that fatal day would be retraced. It is likely that she was in the dome in the sunken lake when the kidnappers came there to receive the ransom money. Dolores liked to hide herself away and read, and she had a well-known penchant for getting into out-of-the-way spaces. That day, she had taken a volume of Sherlock Holmes stories with her into the dome. It would be found on the floor. It is possible, even likely, that Dolores Epstein saw the face of the Ellingham kidnapper, and that is why she had to die. The coach rolled into Burlington. Burlington was a pleasant town, very college, touch of hippie, small town America but with good coffee and snowshoes and yoga and crude profiles of Bernie Sanders spray-painted on walls. There were darker things, too. Signs of homelessness. Some scenes around the courthouse that looked grim. The coach led everyone off on Church Street, which was the main shopping street. Stevie walked down toward the waterfront, taking in the houses and shops and the general scenery.
Ellie could have snuck off to any one of these houses or lofts. She could be hiding away, looking down at Stevie now from a window. But was it so easy to stay concealed in a place like this? Ellie would have to go out eventually, and Burlington wasn't so large. If she had come here, she'd probably gone on, maybe taken someone's car. Maybe she had headed west to the desert or California. Maybe she went up into Canada. That would be a quick and easy way of getting away from the American police. Maybe she had gone to New York or Boston, where it would be easy to hide. But staying hidden forever was hard. Running was hard. You needed money. You needed ID and a phone. And it was hard to hide from cameras. They were everywhere. At traffic lights, at ATMs, on streets. So maybe she was still here somewhere, tucked up in one of these hippie studios. Stevie shook off her deliberations and continued down to the waterfront to the Skinny Pancake. There was a cold wind whipping off Lake Champlain that morning. It snapped in Stevie's face, making her eyes tear up. The view was stunning, what she could see of it through the tears. A smeared expanse of beautiful water, glorious fall trees bordering the other side. This was where Albert Ellingham sailed away on his final day from the local yacht club. His boat had blown upriver a bit. A victim, it was thought, of anarchists who wanted to get revenge for the death of Anton Voracek, the man arrested for the murder of his wife and the kidnapping of his daughter. The anarchists had come for Ellingham before. This time, they seemed to have gotten him. And it was just up the shoreline a bit, in a place called Rock Point, where Albert Ellingham and George Marsh had lowered the marked bills down to a boat. The Skinny Pancake was a large, very low-key place with a hippie vibe, a giant menu of coffees and crepes. Stevie was still in a big mood, money-wise, and ordered a large turmeric cappuccino. Might as well look fancy when you're meeting a professor for the first time.
Hey, Fenton,
the guy behind the counter said.
Usual?
A woman of indeterminate age had entered the restaurant. She had a head of corkscrew curls, an equal mix of black and gray, which came to her shoulders. She wore glasses with thick red frames. She was wearing a bulky purple sweater and a waterproof coat, brown corduroy, and clogs that made a clear, heavy thump on the wooden floor. She had a beat-as-all-hell leather satchel slung across her body. Stevie recognized her a bit from the author photo, although she had been maybe 20 years younger in it. There was something more haphazard about the person in front of her. They looked at each other in a moment of mutual recognition.
Are you Stevie? She called.
Stevie nodded.
Put our coffees together,
she said to the person behind the counter. She's with me. Then to Stevie,
you mind if we sit outside?
Stevie wanted to point out that it was October. In Vermont, on a lake. Dr. Fenton plucked a pack of cigarettes from her pocket and waggled them.
Can't smoke in here, she said, pointing at the door.
Stevie wound her scarf once more around her neck and followed. Dr. Fenton sat down at one of the tables by the door, seemingly unaffected by the wind chopping at them. She pulled a cigarette from the pack of Camels and cupped her hands over her mouth to light it. Stevie didn't know anyone who smoked. Dr. Fenton seemed to pick up on this.
Used to be you could smoke anywhere, she said. You're probably not used to it. They treat us like pariahs.
She took a long drag, followed by a longer exhale.
So, I understand that your interest at Ellingham is the Ellingham case, and that you had something to do with figuring out what happened to that kid, Mays.
Hayes, Stevie said, tucking her arms inside her red coat to conserve warmth.
Hayes.
Dr. Fenton let out a long plume of smoke, most of which was blown back in her face.
Sorry, you've read my book?
Of course, Stevie said.
Of course.
Dr. Fenton laughed and coughed at the same time.
I like that, of course.
Also, call me Fenton. No doctor, just Fenton. It's how I like it. Let's talk about the Ellingham case. Tell me what else you've read.
What? Stevie said. All of it?
All the books. What articles? Give me a sense of what you know.
I know all of it, Stevie said. We're here to talk,
she said.
Talk. Tell me about this case.
Asking someone to just talk about the Ellingham case was like asking someone to just talk about the past or just talk about science.
Starting when? Stevie said. Night of or days leading up to or...
Night of, Dr. Fenton said, the cigarette gripped between her lips. The guy from the counter came out with two coffees and set them down on the table, and Stevie went back to April 13th, 1936, to Albert Ellingham pulling up the driveway. She went through all the known facts about the night, where everyone in the house was, the phone calls, George Marsh's trip, the marked bills, the drop. Occasionally, Dr. Fenton would quiz her. Stevie rattled back the necessary information.
All right, Dr. Fenton said after about a half hour and three cigarettes.
That's good groundwork. Tell me who you think kidnapped Iris and Alice Ellingham. Who is truly devious?
I don't know, Stevie said.
Not Anton Voracek?
Of course not.
Dr. Fenton looked at Stevie for a long moment and sucked on her cigarette. Stevie could hear the paper burning. This case is about money, Dr. Fenton said. It was always about the money. Anton Voracek didn't care about money. To solve the case, follow the money. Whoever kidnapped Iris and Alice knew how much money was in the safe in Ellingham's office. How the hell would Anton Voracek know that?
Because the bank made regular deliveries, Stevie said. The work crew was paid in cash. Lots of people knew that money was there. At least, that's what people said.
Right. So everyone says. Except that those deliveries were done very carefully, and the amount of cash on hand varied. You would have to know when it went in and when it was going to go out.
Stevie said nothing because she agreed. So did most people who looked at the case.
So, Dr. Fenton went on, then you have to look at who is in the house. And plenty of people were in the house. Full-time staff of 20, plus over 100 people on the property every day of the week. The work crew, the staff of the school, and the students, plus guests. Leonard Holmes Nair and Flora Robinson were upstairs, and obviously by the time George Marsh arrived on the scene to help, Flora Robinson could not be found. Loads of people to choose from. But not Anton Voracek. He was an anarchist, unpopular, the perfect patsy when someone had to go down for the crime. I mean, if you're going to believe that, then you probably believe Oswald assassinated Kennedy all by himself. Stevie blinked a little at this. It seemed early to be getting into conspiracy theories. But this is the Ellingham Affair 101, and I think you're a little beyond that. She stubbed out her cigarette on the table, which was kind of gross. The gray ash blew all around.
Okay, she said. You're hired. You have access to the attic in the big house, I hear.
Stevie nodded. Good. Fenton reached into her bag and pulled out a dog-eared legal pad. There are some things I want cross-checked, little details I need to get right. Some of them are architectural. I need to confirm where some things are, what they look like. Some other things you'll probably find up in the attic. I think there are household records up there. I need checks on things like guest lists, schedules, stuff like that. That should be in the household books. She slid the notepad over to Stevie. All those things, she said, check them out for me. Write down any details. This is your job. Go forth and prosper. She shoved the pad at Stevie, who glanced through it. Fenton had questions about things like menus, china patterns, who was at the house on certain dates, the color of the walls, mundane stuff. My book will change everything, Fenton said. I have information that will knock everything sideways.
Stevie looked up in interest. Like what?
That is for me to know, and maybe you to find out if you do your job. This seemed like a big claim, but then again, Stevie had something in her bag at this very moment that could reframe the entire case. She brought it along because she refused to leave it behind when she was not on campus, and also because she'd had a fantasy of showing it to the professor so they could immediately team up to bust the Ellingham affair wide open. Dr. Fenton, or Fenton, had not inspired Stevie to open up. She was somehow sadder than Stevie expected. Maybe it was the cigarettes. Maybe, though, It was something more. Something in her eyes and the way she sat. Something was not right with Fenton. A guy was walking up to them about Stevie's age. He was fair, with a spray of light gold freckles splashed out along his nose and cheekbones. He wore a well-fitted black hoodie with a blue wool jacket on top and a ski hat. He used a single arm crutch on his left arm to walk and had a canvas backpack covered in patches thrown over the other shoulder.
I got a parking space, he said. Hey.
That was to Stevie. This is my nephew, Fenton said. Hunter, this is Stevie. Stevie is my new assistant on the book. You two talk. I gotta hit the restroom. Back in a second. Fenton got up, grabbed the table as if unsteady, and then clomped her way inside. Hunter leaned his crutch against the wall of the cafe and sat down where his aunt had been. They had only a slight resemblance. They had the same large blue eyes. His were bordered by thick blonde brows that were permanently set on furrowed.
You're from Ellingham?
He said.
Yeah, how can you tell?
Your name is Stevie. You're working on this book. You were in the news about the death on campus.
Oh, Stevie said, feeling embarrassed by the obviousness of this. Right.
Have you been interested in the case long?
A few years, she said. He bit his lip and nodded.
I live with my aunt while I go to school here, he said.
Hunter was looking at his aunt's coffee cup. He picked it up as if in an idle gesture, but it was too casual to be really casual. Something flitted across his expression and he set it down.
What do you study? She asked. Ecology,
he replied.
Environmental studies. Going to try to save the world from global warming.
Is that going to work? She said.
We have to try.
She nodded. She got that. You have to try. Trying is the first step to whatever comes next.
I read about what you did, he said. It was cool. You actually solved a crime.
I didn't solve it, she said. I figured some stuff out.
That girl, she's still missing, right?
Ellie, yeah.
I don't know where you go if you run from Ellingham, he said. It's brutal up here.
I'm from Florida. I never know how to cope with this place. He trailed off as if embarrassed by speaking. Then he nodded at the legal pad.
What's my aunt got you doing?
Fact-checking some stuff, she said, I think.
Looks like a lot.
Stevie could hear the clomp of Fenton's clogs on the floor, and she was back. All right, she said. Get started on this. I'll see you midweek.
There's no coach midweek, Stevie said.
Then I'll see you when?
Saturday,
Stevie said. I'll see you Saturday. Come to my house. That's where my office is. I live on campus. Here. She scrawled down an address and passed it over.
Can I email you updates or...
Nothing electronic ever, she said. Ever.
Okay, Stevie said. Nothing electronic. Okay.
Let's get moving. Where's the car?
This way,
Hunter said. He reached over for his crutch.
I'll see you around.
Did she imagine a lilt of hope in his voice? Stevie was not the kind of person who imagined that people wanted to flock to her side. She felt she looked good in her red vinyl coat. Her short blonde hair squashed under a black knit hat, plain black jeans. She was wearing lip balm, so that was something, and an eyebrow goo that Janelle had lent her and said would work well. Janelle knew makeup and was always trying to get Stevie interested in a color palette or a highlighter. Mostly, Stevie forgot she had a body, and when someone else noticed her body, it made her look down and go, "Huh, would you look at that? How long has that been there?" There had only been David for her, like that. She had probably imagined it anyway. Hunter got his crutch and watched as his aunt gathered her things. As they said their goodbyes and went off, she noticed two things. One, Fenton was not so old as to need assistance, and yet it certainly looked like Hunter had come to pick her up and escort her. The second was that he turned and looked over his shoulder at Stevie, and he smiled. 10. Who becomes a murderer? Stevie considered this word as the coach headed back to Ellingham that afternoon. Her reading and viewing and studying had taught her several things. There's the horror movie version. a shadow with a knife, the one who escaped from the hospital on the hill during that storm. It's the person living in the walls. In mystery novels, it might be the smiling stranger, the one with the passing knowledge of poisons. It's the relative left out of the will, or the one recently added to it. It's the jealous colleague at the museum who wants to be the first to announce the new archaeological discovery. It's the overly helpful person who follows the detective around. On the all-murder, true-crime channel, it's the new neighbor with the boat. The one in his mid-40s to mid-50s with the tan who has no past and who recently purchased a human-sized cooler. It's the person who lives in the shack in the woods. It's the unseen figure on the corner of the street. On all crime shows, it's usually the third person the cops interview. It's the one you sort of think it is. In life, the murderer is anyone. The reasons, the methods, the circumstances, the paths to becoming a murderer are as numerous as the stars. Understanding this is the first step to finding a murderer. You have to shut down the voices in your mind that say, it has to be this person. Murderers aren't a type. They're anyone. Stevie put her head against the cool of the window and watched the moose sign go by. No moose, she whispered. Element Walker. Stevie could see her now, almost physically. Artist, try too hard, friendly. The girl with the bruises on her shins from climbing, with the holes in the toes of her cheap satin slipper shoes. The girl with the baby socks tied in her hair and the old cheerleader skirt. Ellie, who had a saxophone as a best friend even though she couldn't play. The girl with the bottle of warm champagne she brought from France that she shared with two people she had just met. Ellie, did you kill someone? Did you mean to do it? Stevie tried to propel her thoughts into the mountain air, as if texting Ellie with her mind. Tell me. I can help you. I'm sorry. Why was she sorry? She had made the right conclusion. She hadn't actually called security. Nate did that. All she did was ask a question. The day had gone gray and the rock walls of the road menaced on either side. This was a hard, beautiful place. It had many nooks, but it was cold and high. Ellie was a creature of color, of people. Stevie saw her as she was on the first day of school, dressing as a messy punk cheerleader with her matted hair bound up in little socks. And then, later that day, dyeing her clothes pink in the bath as she drank champagne with Stevie and Janelle and held court. Ellie liked to perform, not hide out away from society. No, the facts were the facts. She lined them up, measured them. Ellie had written the script and stolen the computer. That was all she said, and it was true. It was true. She could not be blamed for what was true. A couple of days before Hayes's death, someone took Janelle's pass when they were at yoga in the art barn. It could have been anyone. The bag was just sitting out in the hall. But it was someone who knew Janelle had access to the maintenance shed. Someone went into the maintenance shed using Janelle's pass and unloaded a massive amount of dry ice from the storage container. It weighed hundreds of pounds. It would have had to have been moved using a hand truck or a golf cart, something large. From there, it was probably taken down the hatch entrance to the tunnel in the woods. Those blocks would have had to have been carried down the steps, down the tunnel, one by one. Then the room was closed up. To do what? Presumably create fog. But that's not what dry ice does when you leave that much of it in a space for that long. She could see Hayes or Ellie getting the science of it wrong. Neither one of them were big on science, as far as she knew. She could see Ellie messing around to create something for effect, but it never really made sense. Unless Hayes thought he could do some big fog scene, or Ellie thought she would mess up his filming. But why make a big special effect when you don't have anyone down there to film it? And there were easier ways to mess up his filming that would actually work. If not Ellie, who? She leaned her head against the cold of the window, and the word thrummed in time with the moving coach. Murder, 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 murder. Why did Hayes have to die? He was annoying. He cheated and used people, but in the end, he wasn't worth killing. But neither was Dottie, until she saw something she shouldn't have. Could Hayes have seen something? What was there even to see? Her business was working on the Ellingham case, and the world had dropped the biggest, best opportunity right in her lap, working with an author on a book about the case. This was her dream. But Ellie was dancing in her peripheral vision. They were turning onto the school grounds now, taking the treacherous path, the one with the trees so thick and low that they scraped the sides of the coach, and the steep slope that caused the gears to grind. There was the rushing river with the tiny wooden bridge. David had a point. Getting through here was tough. It would be possible, she supposed, to go through the woods, but it would not be easy, and it would be terrifying in the dark. There was no way you could get through them without falling down the slope, tripping over the roots and fallen branches, falling into holes, knocking into rocks. And the only way over the river was the bridge. This was all as Albert Ellingham intended. The place was like a fortress. So if the bridge was watched, and the back road was watched, how did Ellie magic her way out? Getting out of the locked room was almost nothing compared to this. They were cresting now, passing between the dual Sphinx statues. The coach stopped under the great house portico, and she stepped out into a slap of mountain breeze. Would it hurt just to have a look? Just a little look around, to satisfy whatever it was that was eating at her thoughts. Stevie walked around the perimeter of the great house. The back of the building was walled off, enclosing the sunken garden. She wasn't sure which basement window Ellie was supposed to have escaped from, but there were only a few possibilities. The basement leading windows had deep window wells, and these were covered over by grates. Stevie squatted down and pulled on one. It was firmly closed. Forget where Ellie went. How did she even get out of the basement? Stevie couldn't answer the first question until she answered the second. And there was someone who would know that answer. She found him in his usual place, at the big wooden desk right by the entrance door to the great house. Just saying hi, she said as she stepped into the massive vestibule. Larry looked up from something he was writing on a clipboard.
Hi, he said. Also, no.
I didn't ask anything.
You didn't have to. Whatever it is, no.
She pulled over a folding chair that was by the door and sat across from him. I went to Burlington today, she said.
I'm glad to hear it.
To meet with Dr. Fenton, who wrote Truly Devious. Did you read that one?
I can't remember,
he said, still reading down whatever it was on the clipboard. There was a smell in the Great Hall that was unlike anything else at Ellingham. Ellingham was all outdoorsy and wood smoke. The Great Hall smelled of polish, of leather, of cigarettes last smoked in 1938 whose molecules had infested the wood and crystal and marble and produced some new ancient smell. It smelled of wealth, not money. Wealth. It was not like the pong of Fenton's cigarettes, which was stuck in Stevie's hair and her hat. Her vinyl coat was impervious. All hail the vinyl. Okay, she said when Larry refused to look up. I was going to ask something. Larry clicked his pen in warning. I wanted to know if you would show me where Ellie got out.
I think I've answered that,
he said. Isn't it better that I come to you and ask?
Yes. The answer is still no.
Oh, come on, she said, lowering her voice and leaning down over the desk a bit. Don't I deserve to see? Larry's face suggested that she did not. Come on, Stevie tried again, this time with a hint of sadness. I feel responsible. I mean, I brought her here, and if a bear ate her... Nothing. Larry was like the mountain rock they stood upon. She tried to look distraught, but didn't know how to make that happen. She ended up sticking out her lower lip a bit. Larry rolled his eyes and cast a look around the empty great hall.
I'll get you plain coffee K-cups.
Go, Stevie, he said.
All I'm asking is to see where it happened, that's all. It freaks me out. I brought her here, or what I said did. I just want to see it.
Larry clicked his pen a few more times.
If I show you, will you stop?
He asked. Definitely, she said.
Larry tipped his chair back a few inches, lowered his chin, and looked back into the half-open security office door next to him.
Jill,
he said,
take over for a few minutes. I have to go down to the basement.
Yep,
came a voice from within. He reached into the desk drawer and pulled out a set of keys.
Come on,
he said, getting up. Stevie fell in step behind him.
My uncle used to say to me, you're a pain, but I can't see through you, Stevie said.
Your uncle had a point,
he replied.
It's my persistence that made me an Ellingham student.
Uh-huh.
The great house basement was accessed through a door in the kitchen, and the way to the kitchen was a wooden door under the grand staircase, which led to a half set of steps to a partly subterranean space. The kitchen was a cavernous room with a white and black tile floor and white walls. Though the old appliances had long been removed and replaced with modern ones, there was still an air of the 1930s here. The wide wooden counters, a much marked marble-topped table where pastries would have been rolled. There were massive cabinets and pantries, all with whitewashed wooden doors, slightly warped and cracking with age. The windows started only halfway up the wall, making the room slightly darker. Massive globe lights hung from the ceiling. Though it smelled slightly of the faculty's microwaved lunches and dirty coffee mugs, there was still a feeling of authenticity here. Stevie could imagine the house cook and her assistant working away.
This way,
Larry said, taking Stevie to an unmarked white door toward the far side of the room.
Watch the steps, they're warped.
Here, the great house got a bit more real. The basement had a strong basement funk, even from the entrance. A pungent, acrid smell that Stevie could feel on the back of her throat. The steps were saggy and made a noise like a scream when she stepped on them.
You were always going to show me, Stevie said as they went down, weren't you?
If I didn't, you'd find your way down here some other way.
Stevie glowed with pride.
It's a warren down here, so stay with me,
he said. Larry turned to the right, where they were immediately confronted with a wall. There was a small opening to the right side of that, which led to a space just a few feet square. This led to another chamber that was maybe 10 feet square that opened on either side to more little chambers. Each one was dark and had to be lit by a small pull bulb. Stevie had been in the recently excavated tunnel with Hayes the fateful week before he died. She had already been in some claustrophobic spaces. Though this basement was much larger, it had been cut into random little spaces with walls of old brown brick. It was a labyrinth.
What is this?
Stevie asked as they twisted and turned through many tiny hovel spaces.
Albert Ellingham was a weird man,
Larry said.
People always forget that. He was weird. He and his friends used to play games down here. Some of these doors...
They had, in fact, reached a door. He opened it to reveal a bit of brick wall.
Our jokes. And just so people would never learn the layout, he'd regularly have the inner walls knocked down and moved.
That's awesome, Stevie said. Why is this not in any books?
Because no one is allowed down here,
Larry said.
And all these pointless walls aren't on any plans. They're entirely cosmetic. I'd knock them down myself and make this space more useful.
Some of the middle areas were more full of objects, bigger, heavier ones. Large boxes, old appliances, piles of chairs and bits of old furniture. They had to squeeze through some of these. There were some heavy metal hatches in the floor as well. Stevie shone her phone light down on them.
What are these? She asked.
Old storage areas. They used to keep supplies down here. Apples, potatoes, preserved food. Those down there were some of the ice house storage. They'd cut ice in the winter and pack it in with straw. Before there were freezers, there were ice houses. Now,
They had reached one of the larger parts of the basement, a space maybe 20 feet long and half as wide across. It went all the way to the window. Larry pulled his phone from his pocket and turned on the flashlight function.
Right now, he said. We're just under Ellingham's office. This wall,
he tapped his hand on the wall to their right,
is permanent and load-bearing. And right here.
He shone his light along the wall for a moment, then felt along with his hand until he located what he was after. He pressed hard into one of the bricks, and there was a dull sprung. He pushed against a bit of wall, and it gave way, revealing a narrow doorway on a hinge. Stevie instantly made a move for the opening, but he blocked her with his arm.
You can look in, not that there is much to see.
Stevie craned her head into the pitch-black opening. Here, the stench of dust and mold was truly terrible, and she immediately sneezed. She got out her phone and shone it into the darkness. She could faintly make out a passageway, barely 2 feet wide, with a set of stairs at the end.